This is the Get Healthy 360 podcast, where we discuss topics related to your physical, mental, financial, and spiritual health. Your host is Dr. Chris Ferguson, board certified in anesthesiology and pain management. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and you should consult your primary health care provider before making any decisions related to your health. And here's your host, Dr. Chris Ferguson. Oh, one more thing before we start. If you like this episode, please consider rating us 5 stars. We would really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Welcome to Get Healthy 360. We are very honored today to have Dr. Warren M. Grill. He's a professor of biomedical engineering. He is an engineer at Duke. He has numerous appointments and affiliations. He's a professor of biomechanical engineering. He is the Edmund T. Pratt Jr. School Distinguished Professor of Biomedical Engineering. He's a BAS Fellow, Associate of the Duke Initiative for Science and Society, Professor in Neurobiology, Professor in Neurosurgery, Professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, and Faculty Network Member of the Duke Institute of Brain Sciences. This interview is mostly targeted to other physicians, specifically pain physicians, but really anyone, and you probably will need some sort of medical background in order to understand this conversation, because we're going to get fairly detailed in the conversation. So Warren, how did you get interested in the field that you're an expert in, and really what very well known at this point?
Yeah, so my interest, Dr. Ferguson, in neural stimulation arose from an experience I had as an undergraduate at Boston University. I had an opportunity to work in a research lab there for a professor named Herb Voigt, and he was working to understand how acoustic or sound information is coded in the brain, in particular in the cochlear nucleus. And I found that work incredibly fascinating. It was a little bit too basic science for me. I knew I was interested in doing something more applied. And I saw the opportunity of electrical stimulation of the nervous system as a way to do something where it combines the fascinating elements of neuroscience, but something that's more applied, where you can actually impact individuals' quality of life.
So pain is one of the most frequent causes of someone to visit their primary care physician. It's also one of the most frequent reasons that people will take medications. It's one of the root causes of the opioid epidemic, which has killed millions of people in the United States, and people are still struggling with that. And as you mentioned, the nervous system is what allows your brain to sense pain and be aware of pain. So can you describe from the basics what neuromodulation is?
Yeah, so neuromodulation broadly is the use of very small electrical currents applied with something akin to a cardiac pacemaker, but you can think about it as a pacemaker for the nervous system. Very small electrical currents to change the activity in cells of the nervous system, in neurons. And in the case of spinal cord stimulation to treat chronic pain, let's call it a pain pacemaker, the electrical stimulation is delivered to the spinal cord using an electrode that's placed inside the bone of the spine, but outside the dura, which is the protective sac around the spinal cord.
So this pacemaker for your spine adjusts the way the neurons are firing.
Exactly. In traditional spinal cord stimulation, the intensity of those applied currents is large enough to produce activity in neurons. So it produces activity that wasn't there before. And that activity actually travels along the nerve fiber and alters, reduces, or inhibits the activity in neurons that are coding for pain. So it indirectly turns off those neurons that are coding for pain. And the way that it does this is remarkably similar to something that we've all experienced in our everyday lives. When you slam your thumb in the drawer in the morning, when you're going in there to get your spoon to stir your coffee, the first thing you do is rub that thumb. And that rubbing activates a class of nerve fibers called A-beta afferents, a class of nerve fibers. And the activity in those nerve fibers tends to turn off or inhibit pain projection neurons. And that's why when you rub your painful thumb, it feels better. Spinal cord stimulation is, in its most traditional form, producing activity in those same A-beta nerve fibers and turning off those same pain-projecting neurons, just as if you had rubbed the painful area.
Help me and everyone else understand this, where in the early beginnings of spinal cord stimulation, the quote would be about 50% of people would get about 50% pain relief. And exactly like you described, patients would have to get this buzzing sensation to cover up their areas of pain. They would still have some sensation of pain, but it would really just be that buzzing or rubbing sensation that you described. How did the spinal cord stimulation go from needing to feel that buzzing sensation to, the term would be, paresthesia-free or pain relief without that buzzing sensation?
Yeah, so that buzzing sensation arises from activation of those fibers that you would have rubbed in your thumb, or in this case, they're electrically activated by spinal cord stimulation. So that collection of A-beta afferents. And the reason you felt the buzzing is that in addition to turning off those pain-projecting neurons, those same inputs would excite other neurons that made you feel the buzzing sensation.
But how can you get pain relief without the buzzing sensation?
Right. So there are at least two and likely more approaches called subparesthetic spinal cord stimulation, where pain relief can be achieved, but without that accompanying buzzing or accompanying paresthesia. So patients don't feel anything other than the pain relief. The first approach was to turn up the pulse repetition frequency of spinal cord stimulation, how many pulses are delivered to the nervous system every second, from traditional rates of around 50 pulses per second to very, very high rates, 10,000 pulses per second. And the observation was made that with these very high rates of stimulation, pain relief could be achieved in the absence of the tingling sensation. We still don't understand, however, how that very high rate stimulation works. That is, what are the underlying mechanisms by which very high rate spinal cord stimulation operates? The second mechanism or approach to spinal cord stimulation to relieve pain, but without the tingling sensation or paresthesia, has an acronym called FAST, Fast Acting Subperception Therapy. This form of spinal cord stimulation uses a pulse repetition rate more in the traditional range, fit between 50 and 100 pulses per second. And instead of activating those sensory fibers to the thumb, let's call that the center of the receptive field, because that's what the portion of your body that you slammed in the drawer, it activates fibers in the surrounding area or originating from the surrounding area. The surround. And what's unique about those fibers from the surround is that they produce profound inhibition or suppression of the activity in that pain-transmitting neuron. So they produce pain relief, but they don't produce the parallel excitation of other neurons that gives rise to the buzzing, tingling, or paresthetic sensation.
So how does that happen, technically speaking?
Yeah, so the concept of center-surround organization in the nervous system is really common. So we see this in the visual system, in the auditory system. It's prevalent in the retina, for example. It was originally described in the somatosensory system by Hillman and Wall in the late 1960s.
Is that the same wall as Melzack and Wall?
The same wall as Melzack and Wall. And people paid a lot of attention to that Melzack and Wall paper, but not enough attention to the subsequent Hillman and Wall paper where this surround inhibition was described. So this center surround organization means that if you stimulate as traditional spinal cord stimulation does, sensory fibers from the center of that receptive field, those innervating the thumb that you slammed in the drawer, you get that suppression of the pain transmitting neuron, as you pointed out earlier, by about 50%. And you also get, at the same time, excitation that produces that tingling or paresthesia. However, if you stimulate the sensory fibers from the surround, because their connectivity within the spinal cord is different, they produce even more profound inhibition of those pain-transmitting neurons without the parallel excitation that would have caused the tingling or paresthesia.
So how are you targeting that surround inhibition?
So the targeting of surround inhibition has two components to it. The first is a spatial component, and the second is a stimulation parameter component. So the spatial component is determined very much in the same way as traditional paresthesia-producing spinal cord stimulation. That is, you turn up the intensity so the patient does feel that tingling sensation, and you adjust the stimulation field until the stimulation field overlaps the paresthesia produced by the stimulation field overlaps the region of pain. So-called pain paresthesia overlap. And that you have to ask the patient what they're feeling, and you adjust stimulation and to get to that point. And normally you would just leave it like that, right? And the patient would go home and they would have some pain relief. In this case, you actually reduce the intensity of stimulation to below the level where the patient can perceive any paresthesia. And as you do that, you remove the excitation of those axons in the center, and you're left only with excitation of axons from the surround. So it still requires this same spatial mapping, but by changing the stimulation parameters, turning down the amplitude, you get rid of that parasthetic sensation.
And there was a second part. There was the spatial part, and then there was a second part that you talked about.
Yeah, so that would be the stimulation parameter.
Okay.
And this would include the intensity. So turning the intensity or the amplitude of stimulation down below the intensity that produces paresthesia, something that's highly counterintuitive, because the dogma had always been, if you want greater pain relief, you should turn it up more to get greater paresthesia. This is quite counterintuitive to turn it down. Stimulation frequencies between 50 and 100 pulses per second. Again, quite counterintuitive, because prior to this, the dogma had been that to have relief of pain without paresthesia, you needed to use kilohertz frequency spinal cord stimulation, something upward of 1,000 pulses per second. And in most cases, people were advocating 10,000 pulses per second.
How do you explain that, those diametrically opposed thoughts, where there's research coming out saying that at 10,000 hertz, they're getting excellent pain relief, but you're saying at the much lower end, you're also getting pain relief?
Yeah, so I don't think these are opposed to one another. I think what we're seeing is different mechanisms being engaged by each of these two different stimulation approaches. So in the case of FAST, this low frequency, fast acting sub-perception therapy, we are activating surround inhibition. That's the mechanism that's producing pain relief. With kilohertz frequency spinal cord stimulation, it's very clear that we're not engaging surround inhibition, but the mechanism that is being engaged is yet to be determined. So many, many ongoing studies to try to understand what is the mechanism that's being engaged by 10 kilohertz spinal cord stimulation. And things have varied from thermal mechanisms to mechanisms involving glia to mechanisms involving changing the relative strength of synaptic connections.
Now, there's also a lot of talk about different structures to target. So there's the dorsal columns, there are the dorsal horns, there's the dorsal root ganglion, and there's some research that seems to show that all of these might be viable targets. What are your thoughts on the anatomic targets for neuromodulation?
Yeah, I think these are going to be determined in large part by the nature of the pain that's trying to be treated. So, for example, you mentioned, Dr. Ferguson, dorsal root ganglion stimulation or DRG stimulation. This is probably a really good approach if you have highly localized pain. So you can put a lead out a single to stimulate a single dorsal root ganglion and only influence the pain that you happen to have in your right ankle. But if you had more, if you have more widespread pain, particularly bilateral pain that's distributed over multiple dermatomes or over your whole leg, then you're going to have to be putting many, many leads out to cover each of those respective dorsal root ganglion. So probably not a great choice for a patient with that kind of pain scenario.
So I'm going to give you some clinical scenarios that I've done. And before I get into this, I'm going to say very clearly, I have no disclosures of any financial sort. So for anyone that's asking. So I've used a system that targets the dorsal root ganglion. And I've actually used all the systems. So there's a patient with severe pain of just the feet. Very pleasant lady, severe pain of her feet to the point where she developed this condition. For anyone who isn't familiar with it, it's complex regional pain syndrome. And she was housebound, could not leave her house because of the pain of just any sort of touching of her feet would be severe. So normally I would use the dorsal ganglion stimulator to target just her feet. And the results are good. But in this case, I decided to go with the FAST system. And it seems like there's a lot of talk as to where to put the leads. But to me, it seemed like if you were targeting the nerve or the dorsal ganglion, it's still a highway. So if you just targeted it where it was coming out of the spinal cord, it would work just as well. So I just put the leads at the conus where those lower lumbar segments were coming out and going to the feet. So the patient was on the table, severe pain, and turned on FAST, and immediately no pain. I have never seen anything work this quickly. And she had no sedation for the spinal cord stimulator trial, immediate pain relief, and she walked out. She came in a wheelchair, walked out with no pain. And she subsequently did great with the trial, did great with the implant, and is on no pain medication and is really back to being a normal person. And she actually was on the news. And if anyone Googles my name, you can see the news testimonial of how she did. But it was a phenomenal result. So can you explain to me why that worked? Yeah, it did. It worked really well.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Logically, to me, it makes sense, but the mechanistically, I don't know why. The other reason is there's another patient that has severe diabetic neuropathy. His hemoglobin A1C is well controlled. He has a dorsal root ganglion stimulator that I put in, and he was getting 40 to 50% pain relief, but he has a very white collar job and does not want to be on any medication. He's just on some gabapentin and some Cymbalta, but he doesn't want to be on any because he wants to be as sharp as possible. So he lobbied his insurance company, and we did the trial with Boston Scientific, which is what uses the FAST system, and he just got the implant. And during the trial, we ran just the FAST system, just the dorsal root ganglion system, and then we ran them together. And he actually did worse when both systems were being run together, which was counterintuitive. With just the dorsal ganglion stimulation, he was getting, again, 40 to 50% pain relief. But with just the FAST system, he was getting 75% pain relief and was very, very happy. So if you can explain that one as well.
Yeah, certainly, Dr. Ferguson. So I think first, just so that your audience is clear, I'm a biomedical engineer, not a physician. So I don't treat patients, although I interact closely with physicians who do treat patients. And the stories that you described are certainly not unique. As we in my lab at Duke University have been trying to understand the mechanisms behind FAST, we've spoken to many clinicians, and I keep hearing similar stories where patients walk in severely disabled by their pain. Even patients who are currently experiencing some pain relief from traditional spinal cord stimulation, they get programmed with FAST, and they have immediate and dramatic reductions in their pain. and they walk out of the office a transformed person. So first to the woman that you described, I think what you're seeing here is a reflection of the power of this surround inhibitory mechanism, which again is not something that anyone invented. Just Mother Nature happened to put it together as a component of the way the nervous system operates, that inputs from a surrounding receptive field produce inhibition of the center of that receptive field in a very powerful way. And this is really, really put there to increase contrast, to allow us to detect edges, whether we're looking at it visually, whether it's a sound edge, or whether it's the edge of our desk that we're feeling with our hand. This center surround inhibition greatly increases contrast. So by activating those axons that originate from that surround, you get that robust inhibition of the center of that receptive field, or the area where pain is originating. The second part of this that I alluded to earlier, but I'll amplify now, is the stimulation pulse repetition rate. And this relates a little bit to your second case and the interaction between FAST and DRG stimulation as well. So each time that stimulator delivers a pulse, it produces an action potential or a signal in those nerve fibers that are being stimulated. And that action potential travels into the circuit of the spinal cord and inhibits those pain transmitting neurons or turns them down. That process has time delays in it. So it has what we would call in engineering dynamics. And how efficiently or how effectively you turn down that pain transmitting neuron or reduce or inhibit its activity is dependent on those delays. And so by choosing an appropriate pulse repetition frequency, you can get maximal inhibition or turning off of that pain transmitting neuron. So again, two key components: activating the correct axons from the surround receptive field and activating them at the appropriate times so that you get that maximal suppression.
So I may be oversimplifying this, but would this be akin to wave dynamics, where you have one electrical wave canceling out the other wave, and that's why it's not as effective? Or am I not thinking about it properly?
That's what I would hypothesize is the explanation for the interaction that you saw between FAST and DRG. So in that case, both of those applied stimuli are producing activity in some cases, very likely the same nerve fibers, and two signals or action potentials traveling on a nerve fiber that meet each other are like two trains running on the same track. They can't pass each other. They crash into each other and they are annihilated. So they can't pass by, just like two trains on the same track. So if you stimulate the DRG with one modality and you stimulate the dorsal columns or the conus with another modality, those action potentials can cancel each other out and never reach the area of the spinal cord stimulation where inhibition of that pain-transmitting neuron is occurring. And I would hypothesize that that's what you saw in the case that you described.
Because I've also done this where, and I presented this as a NANS poster maybe 2 years ago, where there was a patient with complex regional pain syndrome of her knee, and she got about 50% pain relief with a dorsal ganglion stimulator. And with the same company, I used their dorsal column stimulator, and the combination of their two stimulators gave almost 100% pain relief. But because those were, I'm guessing because they were synergistic waves, that's why they were additive. But that would imply then that the FAST system is a distinctly different wave pattern than other systems, because it's actually canceling the other ones out. Or am I off on that?
That's one potential explanation. Another has to do with how you programmed the dorsal column stimulator. And in the former case, the gentleman that you described, it sounded like the dorsal column component of that dual stimulation, which you did with FAST, was likely engaging some of the same nerve fibers as the DRG stimulator was, and therefore you were getting this cancellation effect. Whereas in the latter case that you described, it's likely that the that either purposely or apparent or just good fortune, that the dorsal column stimulator was activating a different set of nerve fibers than the dorsal root ganglion stimulator, and therefore you didn't see this cancellation effect or collision effect that we described earlier.
So help me understand this one. Here's another case. So there's a lady with abdominal pain for years. She did very well with something called a superior hypergastric nerve block, which means I blocked the sympathetic nerves in her pelvis. Did great with that for a couple hours, pain came back. So we progressed on to a spinal cord stimulator trial. So the representative from the company was doing the paresthesia mapping, and it was just all he would get was back pain and lower extremity pain. And again, because it's the pelvis, I just put the leads at the top of T11 to cover the pelvis. So he was doing the paresthesia mapping, and he just couldn't get that paresthesia mapping into the pelvis. So I suggested just turn it off and run the FAST system because it's different mechanisms of action. And he spent a while trying to get the paresthesia mapping. I just run the FAST, ran FAST, 100% immediate on the table, pain relief. It's a two-part question. First, how do you explain the disconnect between the paresthesia mapping and the pain relief? And the other question is, do you need paresthesia mapping?
Yeah, so I'm not sure in this case how to explain the mismatch between the paresthesia mapping and the eventual pain relief by FAST.
Because it's a few cases, it's very common in abdominal pain for that. So I don't know if you have...
Yeah, so just one thing I think it's just important to think about is that abdominal pain, particularly if it's originating in the viscera, is going to be quite different than the somatic neuropathic pain kinds of conditions that we were speaking about earlier. And it's a little bit less clear to me how there's an interaction then between the somatic A beta fibers in the dorsal columns that we're traditionally stimulating and the sensory input that's coming in from the viscera, which is those axons don't travel in the dorsal columns. So it's quite a different organization. To your second question, whether a paresthesia overlap is required, I don't think we have sufficient data to know. So it seems to be sufficient. The clinical experience would suggest that paresthesia overlap is sufficient to get the FAST effect, but that doesn't, we can't yet extrapolate that to say it's required. And the experiences that you're describing would suggest that it's not required, that you can engage a sufficient number of axons originating from the surround without this profound overlap between pain and paresthesia.
So long-term, the concern would be, what are your thoughts on patients developing tolerance to this therapy?
Yeah, so the data that I've seen, which are those that are publicly released on FAST, have looked at this at 1 year, and the pain relief in that cohort of patients at 1 year was identical to what was observed at 1 month. So at least over the force of the course of that first year of use, there didn't seem to be any indication of tachyphylaxis. When I think about this broadly in the context of spinal cord stimulation, I've come to the view that these different approaches, traditional paresthesia to producing spinal cord stimulation, kilohertz frequency, sub-perception spinal cord stimulation, and fast-acting sub-perception therapy are each engaging different neural mechanisms. And what that means is that if a particular patient is programmed with one of these approaches and they leave your clinic and they're getting 80% pain relief and they're quite happy, and 2 years later they come back and they say, hey, you know, this thing is not working like it used to, and I'm getting pain back, that in addition to the kind of old approach of reprogramming that existing approach, right? Let me change the contact configuration, maybe increase the stimulation amplitude a little bit, see if we can recover pain relief. Now there's an approach where you can say the paresthesia producing traditional spinal cord stimulation doesn't seem to be working for you anymore. I'm going to try one of these other modalities and switch over to FAST or switch over to kilohertz frequency spinal cord stimulation. So I think it's a new paradigm beyond just changing parameters of one approach, but actually if that approach is no longer working, since there are different mechanisms being exploited by these different approaches, changing to one of the other approaches.
So theoretically, could you build in a program that auto-cycled the programming?
Yes, you could conceivable to program a system to deliver, rotate through these different therapies.
And of course, that I'm sure theoretically would have to be optimized as to what a good rotating cycle would be. Would it be minutes, yeah, days, hours, months, et cetera?
And you could even envision it being driven not by a cycle, but by the patient themselves, right? So they say, boy, this particular modality really helps a lot when I'm taking my dog for a walk. And so I turn that one on when I go for a walk, but when I'm sitting, you know, having dinner, it's this other modality that gives me best pain relief. So I turned that one on.
So this stimulation typically is used for back pain, complex regional pain syndrome. It just became FDA approved for diabetic neuropathy. Where do you see this type of technology helping in the future? What type of pain do you think would be applicable for spinal cord stimulation?
Yeah, I think, anywhere that we can identify that the presence of this surround inhibitory mechanism. And one very challenging area that comes to mind is headache pain, for example, where there have been cases of occipital nerve stimulation for treatment of headache pain with actually quite good efficacy, but very high complication rates. And that's largely why that approach has been abandoned. And so one potential advantage of targeting the surround would be that there may be more convenient locations to put the electrode to engage the surround that are less mechanically demanding than stimulating the occipital nerve directly, where there was lots of challenges with electrodes either being displaced or fracturing as a result of the great amount of movement around the neck. So that's one place where I think it would be potentially very promising.
And where do you see, if you could design the perfect system going forward, you could just wave your wand and design the perfect neuromodulation system, what would that look like?
Well, the manufacturers probably wouldn't like this very much, but I have this vision of the future of neuromodulation as one of exploiting the plasticity and learning that is inherent in the nervous system. So the way that all of our neuromodulation devices work now, whether it's deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease or spinal cord stimulation for chronic pain or sacral nerve stimulation for urinary incontinence, any of these, therapeutic relief only occurs when the device is turned on. And if you turn the device off, the symptoms come back. The time course can be variable across symptom and across those three example diseases that I gave, but invariably the symptoms come back. And you need to turn the device back on if you want to regain symptom relief. So I envision a future where the therapy is curative, meaning that we determine how to deliver stimulation in such a way as to reprogram the nervous system, which we know is possible, right? We all learn how to do things, and that learning is essentially reprogramming the nervous system. Reprogram the nervous system to reverse whatever pathology is leading to the disease to begin with. And under those kinds of circumstances, you either, one, would only need your stimulator temporarily to drive that initial change, or two, you would need it infrequently. So you can imagine driving the change, okay, I no longer have the symptoms of urinary incontinence. 9 months from now, I start to feel some urgency. All right, I need a dose. So I'm going to turn on my stimulator for a day. It's going to, again, drive my nervous system back toward that healthy state. I turn it off and I'm set for another year or whatever it might be. So that's the kind of picture that I have in my mind about where we as a field should be thinking of taking these devices.
So anecdotally, it's interesting that you brought that up. There is a condition often there's abdominal pain and then there's gastroparesis. And anecdotally, I'm aware of some cases that the patient had a dorsal column stimulator for the abdominal pain. And then after a few years, the spinal cord stimulator helped the abdominal pain and also helped the gastroparesis. The really interesting thing to touch off what you said is that after a few years, the patient would turn off the spinal cord stimulator and the pain would be gone and the gastroparesis has resolved. And then after a few more years, they just had to take the spinal cord stimulator out because they didn't need it anymore. How far away do we think you are or the field is from doing that? Because it seems like they're getting there almost.
Yeah, and there are other anecdotal examples of stimulation having permanent lasting effects. So for example, Anders Lozano in Toronto reported a series of patients who had deep brain stimulation for essential tremor. And in some subset of those individuals, when the stimulator was turned off, their tremor did not return. So they were, for all intents and purposes, they had been cured. So it's happening now, but it's just anecdotally. And we are beginning to understand well what is the relationship between the pattern of activity in a neuron? That's what we can control with electrical stimulation, when and how much a neuron fires, that pattern of activity in a neuron, and how that influences the strength of its connections to other neurons, which is what we would need to manipulate in order to design therapies that take advantage of this plasticity and are curative rather than therapeutic. And so I think we're on the cusp of this, and I think the part that I find particularly exciting is that it doesn't necessitate that we develop a lot of new technology. Right, we have great ways to stimulate the nervous system safely and effectively. What it requires is that we develop the understanding of how to deliver that stimulation to drive these plastic changes.
I think the last question that I'll leave the audience with is, what's something that you wish physicians knew about neuromodulation that they often don't?
I do a lot of teaching also. In addition to running a research program here at Duke, I teach every semester both undergraduate and graduate students. And one of the things that's really been great, particularly in the graduate classes that I teach, is because we're located immediately across the street from the Duke Health, we have physicians who come over and lecture in our classes to tell students, here's how I actually make use of the technology that you're talking about in this class in my clinical practice. And one thing I've come to observe is that I wish that every physician who delivered neuromodulation could at the chalkboard draw the output of what that device looks like. And as they change the knobs when programming the device, how does the output of that device change? So the amplitude of voltage or the current, the duration of the pulse repetition rate. And I've seen a remarkable amount of conflation, confusion of what those knobs, if you will, actually change about the stimulation that's being delivered. So I think having them being able to draw that on the blackboard would be really helpful, because I think they would be able to do a better job of programming their patients if they had a better understanding of what that device was actually delivering to the nervous system.
I think that would be a really useful thing that clinicians know how to do. I would second that. So Dr. Grill, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It was very educational.
Thank you, Dr. Ferguson. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Again, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're very, very busy being a professor. Have a great day.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and visit the Get Healthy 360 Facebook page. We are always looking for feedback and new story ideas. Thanks again, and see you next time.